Gary Nicholas is all. Jack Goddamn Nicholas himself. GPTEL. Greatest player to ever live, to most. And Gary, heir to the Bear, son of greatest player to ever live, to most. Son who finally got his tour card the year before after 10 years of trying. A certain caddy gulped. These two golf families had crossed swing paths before. Jack and Bob were once in the final pairing at a U.S. Senior Open. And Nicholas once took David out for a practice round at the 1992 U.S. Open and taught him a lesson about golf management. They were standing on the tee box at the famous 18th when Nicholas said, "How do you plan on playing this one?" David said he'd probably just bomb a driver off the tee and try to reach the green in two. Nicholas shook his head. "Too risky," he said. "There's a sprinkler out there that reads 102 yards. You need to play this hole so that your third shot comes from right near that sprinkler head. Whatever two shots get you there, whether it's a 3-wood and a 6-iron or 2 4-irons, whatever, get there." Duval says it made him start thinking about the idea of playing a hole backward to get the most out of it. So off we went, Nicholas, the old god, with Duval, god in training. Duval seemed totally at ease with the situation. Me, I was a mental pretzel. I've interviewed Nicholas for 15 years, and he's always been one of the best and most generous quotes I've ever known. But being on the course with him, it was even better. For one thing, he was funny. One time, on the second hole, Bob hit a tee shot that hooked nasty left into severe spinach. "What's over there?" Bob asked his caddy. "Your ball," Nicholas cracked out of the side of his mouth. One time, Nicholas hit a drive that was headed for a fairway bunker. "That's close, Jack," said his caddy. "Close," said Nicholas, disgusted. "The only thing that's close to is us." The whole day, Nicholas was goggle-eyed and drooling over David's distance. On the first hole, for instance, a 346-yard par 4, I paced off the distance David had left to the green, 5 yards. Nicholas's eyes bugged. On the fifth, the 305-yard par 4, we had to hit a 3-wood or we'd fly the green. It rolled into the greenside bunker, but all we did then was hole the damn thing. I high-fived him as he emerged victoriously from the bunker. And I'm thinking, "Sports Center, here we come." Didn't happen. Meanwhile, the Nicholas boys couldn't light a match with a flamethrower. Nothing happened for them. Zilch. Nada. Nicholas just kept looking at us like a hungry kid with his nose pressed to the window of a McDonald's. We made birdie after eagle and birdie. We were going so good, I just had to ask the ultimate question as we marched down the fairway. "David, is it all right if I put my mouth on your ball?" He looked at me as if I'd just sneezed in his ball pouch. "No, dude, use the towel." "No," I explained. "What I meant is, can I speak to your ball as it's flying?" He thought about that for a minute and said, "Don't. You might jinx it." As deliberate and methodical as Duval looks, he actually is very quick out of the box and almost impossible to keep up with, much less get ahead of to get the mark and the number. He could sense I was constantly lagging, and he kept looking at somebody in the crowd and touching his right wrist. Finally, I got up the nerve to ask, "Who are you looking at in the crowd, and what does that mean when you touch your right wrist?" "I'm signaling Mitch," he said, pointing to Mitch, who was walking along outside the ropes. "I want him to bring in the reliever." That, of course, would be Mitch himself. To replace me. Duval grinned larcenously. The day was a joy. Duval was funny, talkative, loose. Come to think of it, so was the whole damn group. One of the other caddies had a line when Duval smashed another driver 340 down the middle. "There's some heat on that toast." Now that's pure caddy. I really need to come up with my own. I thought of a few. "Close the shutters, Granny, it's hail and ballada." Or, "Ooh, they felt that one at the factory." Or, "Damn, that makes me slightly moist." Still no good. I had one line that Bob thought was halfway funny. He hit a great 5-wood to knock it on a par 5 in 2, and I said, "That's why you've been named Father of the Year 7 years in a row." At the turn, the hilarious on-again-off-again tour player Charlie Reimer was interviewing all the players for some ESPN package. He'd been Duval's roommate in college and had occasionally caddied himself. I asked him if he had any advice for me. "When you're a caddy, there's 3 tried-and-true responses that'll keep you out of trouble. They are 1. Good shot. 2. Sorry, my fault. And 3. You got fucked. By the 14th hole, we were a jaw-dropping 10 under and had the freaking lead. Imagine that. Jam boy in the lead. Then Bob eagled the par 5 16th hole to get us to 12 under. Meanwhile, the poor Nicholas boys were on their way to a top 12, still at 1 under, last place. I thought about all the other father-son teams in history. Raymond Floyd and Ray Jr., Dave Stockton and Dave Stockton Jr., Arnold and Deacon Palmer. But I couldn't imagine a team that could have beaten these two, can you? Bob and David looked at each other and thought about it, and then Bob said, "Well, honestly, no." And they both laughed. It's been a long, strange trip back for the two of them from that day when Brent Duval was 12, and the doctor told them what was wrong. Brent was usually so energetic and funny, but suddenly he started losing zip. You could see it when he played on the Little League team with his 9-year-old brother David. Turns out Brent had aplastic anemia. Basically, his bone marrow had stopped working. Next thing you knew, they were in Cleveland, testing the whole family for possible bone marrow donors. There was one match, David. In his book, Bob recalls, David took it terribly. He'd seen the huge needles they used on his brother. It was going to be painful, and he knew it. But David did it, and they brought the bags of marrow into Brent and stuck the needles into him and fed him the very essence of his own brother. And right away, it seemed to heal Brent from the inside out. It seemed as if David had saved his life. A few days later, they all went out to lunch, Brent's first trip out of the hospital in months. But when they got back to the hospital, Brent threw up the lunch. Brent was rejecting the transplant. He immediately started getting worse. They took David in to see him once, near the end, and David screamed, "That's not my brother!" and ran out. He never saw him again. The Little League team served as Brent's pallbearers. David hates talking about it, but his father says, "David blamed himself for Brent's death, and I blamed myself too." For years after, Bob felt hollow, miserable, useless. A country club pro, just as his own father was, he hated having to fake a good mood when he gave the members lessons, so he found that good mood in liquor. The booze and the grief made for a very tense house. Finally, he got a divorce, deciding that he had to take care of himself if I was going to take care of my kids. At first, David hated his father for walking out on his mother. He holed up inside himself to keep from having to talk about it. But as he grew up, he learned to understand how thickly webbed the situation was. He began to open up to his father again, began to see him as a man who'd been through the same sorrow he knew so well himself. Brent changed them both. They don't speak much about him, but they never forget him. As Bob wrote, "The scar remains, but the wound has healed." Now father and son are buddies again. In fact, Bob and his new wife Sherry live near him. Most of the time, Bob comes to David's house by boat. Then they go fishing together, or hit balls, or just shoot the breeze. And tomorrow they would try to win their first pro tournament together in their very first try if their doofus caddy didn't blow it. As David said, "How cool is this?" We wound up the day at 12 under 60 and tied for the lead with Brad Faxon and Billy Andrade, who are best friends and who tend to take home the coveted denim jackets the winners get at this thing. Faxon had won it 4 times already, and Andrade too. Boys, how about sharing a little? Not a caddy for even 1 year, and I was already playing in the final group. I dumped the bag in the locker room, cleaned up, and headed upstairs to the press room. For once, I was going to know more about the rounds of the leaders than maybe the leaders themselves. I kept imagining the questions from the press. Media member, David, how invaluable was your caddy today in forging out this crucial halfway lead? Duval, well, it was just a delight to be with him today. He's forgotten more about golf than I'll ever know. He kept my swing on plane, my head screwed on right, and most important, always had my dip ready. Instead, Duval never showed up. In fact, nobody showed up in the press room to be interviewed. Not a single player. The press was well and truly screwed. But Duval was the one they were most pissed about. The co-leader, the recent British Open champion, wasn't coming in to talk to about 40 press members who happened to be on deadline. I went down to the player lounge and just casually asked Duval why he wasn't going up to the press room. Well, he said the press guy asked me if I wanted to come up there, and I said, do I want to? No, I don't want to. He seemed all right with that answer, so I didn't. And neither did anybody else. I understand where Duval comes from with the press. They mostly want to ask him why nobody's risen up and stopped Tiger. But you're talking about a force never before seen in golf. It's like saying, why doesn't anybody do anything about the damn hurricane? Duval will go down in history as the guy who was the last number one in the world before Tiger took it over and stuck it in his back pocket for the next, well, God knows how many years. But for Duval, overcoming what he has, his shyness, his weight, and his own family sorrows, gives him plenty satisfaction enough. He is a reader and a thinker, and golf is only one part of his complex life. He was never meant to be Tiger, and even if he were as good as Tiger, he couldn't, wouldn't, handle the Klieg lights pouring on his face at all times. The sunglasses shield only so much. But nobody wants to hear all that, so he goes to the press room only when somebody says, you have to. But if I were that PR guy, I'd have had his butt up there. The next morning, I got to the course early. Wanted to be ready this time. Wanted to clean the grips early. Get the dip lined up. Get the swoosh outlined real neat and nice. Problem was, I couldn't find the bag. Uh-oh. I'd left it overnight in the locker room with all the other bags. I knew Mitch said that was a cardinal sin, but I checked with the rent-a-cop in the locker room, and he said there was going to be somebody stationed in there around the clock. So I figured, why lug it back to the hotel? I went to dinner with a bunch of the caddies, and David and Bob went out with some Nike people, and everything was not only hunky, but dory as well. Until that morning. Ever wreck your dad's car? This is how it felt inside, times 10. I'd lost the clubs that won the British Open, shot the 59, and were leading the Fred Meyer Challenge. I'd lost Picasso's brushes, Coltrane's sax, Rosie O'Donnell's fork. I sat on a bench, white-faced. I could have cried. Suddenly, I saw Mitch and Duval peering around the corner of some lockers, snickering at me. Behind them was the bag. Bastards. They'd taken it back to the room with them the night before. Cardinal sin, Mitch said. We never, ever leave the bag. Nowhere, no how. We went to the range. Despite the gallon or so of caffeine he'd already gulped, Duval carries himself with such grace, elan, and patience you'd think he was on beta blockers. There doesn't seem to be the slightest strain in his game. Even his swing, so fluid and beautiful, ends up leaving him straight as a 2x4, not contorted or bent. He warms up without a target, too. I just swing down my body line, he says, and work on tempo. And my God, is his tempo sweet. Bob says he may have learned that tempo through the range games the two of them played when he was small. They tried to see if he could hit a 5-iron to every green on the range. 90 yards, 120, 150, 170. He bet him he couldn't hit high shots with a 4-iron, punch shots with a sand wedge, big sweeping cuts and low darting hooks, punches and floaters and sailors and screamers. And now those shots are all there when he needs them. Same with putting. Duval is so still when he putts that he purposely rests his sand wedge against his left leg as he practices putts. It never even wobbles. And he only putts a few long ones and a few short ones. Most pros have a Marquis de Sade approach to putting practice. They'll force themselves to stay out there until they've made 25 four-footers in a row, or 10 three-footers, 10 four-footers, and 10 five-footers all in a row. Sink once told me how he never ends a practice session until he makes 40 four-footers in a row, all in a circle around the cup. Maybe he should have practiced two-footers, because that's the length he missed on the 72nd hole at Southern Hills to blow his spot in the playoff at the 2001 U.S. Open. But Duval doesn't practice the short ones over and over. In fact, he doesn't really care if he misses them. He barely watches. You miss him, you miss him. You're only human. And you wonder if Brent taught him that, too. As soon as we started on number one, the very likable Mr. Faxon started knifing us in the back, and in the front, and in the sides. He and the world's greatest putting stroke started making everything. It was useless. 10 feet, 40 feet, 75 feet, he canned them all. It was like his ball was allergic to daylight. We weren't playing badly, but by the 9th hole we were 4 behind. What was weird is that Faxon kept asking Andrade for advice on putts, or he'd ask his caddy, Tom Chop Lamb. Finally, after he'd poured in another putt just slightly longer than Highway 1, I stuck the flag in the hole and said, "Faxy, you've made everything you've looked at. Why the hell are you still asking people for advice?" And Faxon looked at me with a grin and said, "Because we're on TV, you idiot." I have so much to learn. Chop got a good line off on 10. I was anxious to reach a green at least once before Duval, so maybe I started moving a hair quicker than appropriate as Faxon was through the ball. And Chop said, "You trying to quick trigger, my man?" Another great caddy gloss. Could be used in other facets of life, too. "Honey, last night in bed, were you trying to quick trigger me?" We were getting hopelessly thumped by Faxon's putter, but I still had my moment of glory. It was on 13. Andrade was coming out of the rough on the left, 30 yards behind us. After he hit a shot, the big crowd kept walking, not realizing Duval was about to play his shot. He stood over it in the noise and then backed off. "Stand still, please," I bellowed, holding my arm up. I was loud, forceful, and authoritative. I could easily have been mistaken for General George Patton, or at least Newt Rockne. 300 people froze in their tracks. They damn well better. It's one thing for a marshal to say it, a whole nother thing to hear it from a caddy. In a game of Stratego, players would be 1, caddies 2, and marshals 8. I was feeling very powerful and satisfied. In perfect silence, Duval hit a great shot, and in the middle of the big roar said to me out of the corner of his mouth, "You've wanted to say that your whole life, haven't you?" "Honestly?" I said. "Yes." As we came up 18, the throngs were huge, bleachers and packed tents and thousands of people. It was a thrill. I asked Duval if he thought his dad enjoyed the 2 days. "Oh, man," he said, looking at all the people. "He ran a pro shop for 30 years. How good is this?" Bob was loving it. He was going in for shoulder surgery the next week, so this would be his last taste of golf for 6 good months. We were going to finish with a 63 in third place, but it didn't matter a lick. "I never dreamed I'd be here," he said. "I never thought I'd be playing with my son in front of 30,000 people. It's like a dream." And for just a second there, I got to thinking about my dad. And I got to thinking how great it would have been to play in just one tournament with him. But even after he stopped drinking, I was still angry at him and, underneath that, scared of him, too. And when I finally stopped being scared of him, he was too old to play anymore. Too bad, too. He was good. He shot a 63 once on sand greens. He was always coming home with some Elks Club championship trophy under his arm or Moose Lodge championship plaque in his trunk. I always wanted to go with him, but he never took me. Maybe I never asked. Watching the Duvals and the Nicklauses, it made me pine to go back and rethink some of those years. I'd love to go back and see my dad as just a guy, just like me, with his goodnesses and his faults. I'd love to play just one two-man best ball with him. I think we'd be right in it, too. We'd come down to the final hole with a chance to win it, and maybe we'd both think, "How good is this?" If the caddy says, "What did we post? How's 8 sound? Man, we had the beast singing. All day we were drawing steel and ripping cloth. We keep raking like this and I'm going to be winner, winner, chicken dinner." He means, "What score did my player shoot? How does 8 under par sound to you?" "Sir, he was really hitting his driver well. The entire round we were taking our irons out of the bag and hitting the ball very, very close to the flagstick. If we continue to play this well, I will be buying my hotel roommates dinner, as it is customary for the winning caddy to do this." Chapter 6. Dewey Tomko. Just a little old $50,000 Nassau. The leading money winner in golf may not be Tiger Woods. It might just be a former kindergarten teacher with 38 clubs in his bag, Vaseline on all the faces, and a gambling Jones that could fuel the state of Nevada. His name is Dewey Tomko. He's 55, built like a newspaper stand, and wears a crew cut that sticks up like a garden rake. He putts between his legs and will shake your hand only with the ends of his fingers in case you've been sent to break his knuckles. You can only pray to Jesus you never meet him on the first tee. Nick Price won't bet him. "I'm scared of you," Price tells him. PGA Tour pro Danny Ellis won't either. "I'll play with him, but never for money," he says. "He's too good. He's way too good." Tomko is the world's biggest golf gambler. He plays $50,000 Nassau's, in which there are three separate bets, the front nine, the back nine, and the entire 18. Two down automatics, sometimes with three and four guys at once. He has won more than $1 million in one round and dropped more than $1 million in one round. He will bet on anything, anytime, with anyone. He once bet $100,000 he could make more free throws wearing cowboy boots and a sport coat than another man wearing a sweatsuit. And won. He once bet $10,000 that two raindrops making their way down a window pane would collide. And lost. He once bet a man $300,000 he couldn't lose 100 pounds in a year. "And we had a rule," Dewey says. "Any body part he cut off, we had to weigh." He let the guy buy out for half. Of course, the only thing dumber than betting Dewey Tomko on the golf course is trying to make it up afterward in cards. Dewey is one of America's most dangerous poker players, having finished second twice in Binion's World Series of Poker. He also happens to be one of the world's largest sports bettors and one of the few that actually makes money from it. But you know what proves he's the biggest gambler of all? The fact that he agreed to let an accident-prone caddy anywhere near him in the first place. Before he'd give me his bag, Dewey insisted I understand gamblers' golf rules. "First off, no out-of-bounds," Dewey says. "That means if you can find it, hit it. If it's in the halfway house, hit it. If it's in the bank drive-through, hit it. If it's in the back seat of somebody's Honda, hit it. No gimmies, never. That's cost guys a few thou, slapping it away from the hole toward their cart and hearing Dewey go, "Dang, pards, that's going to be a tough three-jack from there." No free drops anywhere, anytime. No drops from drains, flower gardens, plugs, rodent holes, ground under repair, women's purses, nothing. "Don't even lean over like you might touch it," Dewey says. "Don't even lean over to tie your shoe." In Dewey's world, if you're in the rough and you bend over and they can't quite see what you're doing, you lose the hole. "Well, okay, you can move it off a sprinkler head," Dewey says, "but only because they were ruining too many sprinkler heads, and Dewey owns the course where some of the biggest action in the nation happens. He bought it with his World Series of Poker winnings. It's called Southern Dunes in Haines City, Florida. If you're not willing to lose 5 or 10 large, don't get within a par 5 of it. We tap down all the damn spike marks we want. No 14-club rule. With these boys, you can take as many as your bag will hold. When I picked up Dewey's huge pro bag, I wanted to call my chiropractor. He's got 38 clubs, including 7 wedges, one for every 5 yards. That way, I got no half shots," he says. "He also carries 2 putters, in case one goes bad. He carries metal woods 1 through 11, including a 2.5. He carries a left-handed tree club, a tiny left-handed club for tight spots, and a tiny right-handed club. He might use them only once a year, but they might save him $50,000 some days. Some guys carry smooth-faced clubs with no grooves. Some guys carry clubs with a special groove that makes it cut every time and stop on a dime. It's a very sporty little crowd. There's no same ball rule either. For very windy holes, for instance, Dewey carries the smaller English balls to bore through the hawk. If he's playing a hole where you need distance, he might switch to a top flight. Hell, if he's got a cut going, he might play a Polaris. One time Dewey was playing Davis Love, and Dewey blew it 70 yards by him with a greased hook-face driver and a little rocket ball he happened to have around. Grease up. Use Vaseline, KY jelly, even chapstick. If it works in porn, it works in this game. Dewey let me hit a few drivers with grease, and I've never hit the ball farther or straighter. I was 50 yards longer and 30 yards straighter than I'd ever been. I kept looking for my slice and never saw it. "Problem is," says Dewey, "you get addicted. Pretty soon you're going greased from 80 yards. You can't stop." The other problem, it's completely illegal in any other game. No bolting. "You can cuss, you can spit, you can take your pants off and play, you just can't leave," he says. "If you do, you pay all bets always through the 9 or the equivalent of a large 4-bedroom ranch. No handicaps. Gamblers don't have handicaps. "Never had one in my life," Dewey says. "I'd guess about a 5. I never turned in a score in my life. Handicaps are for guys to cheat with. They don't turn in the good ones and only turn in the bad ones. Why do I need a handicap? I ain't gonna cheat you. 'cause if I cheat you, I get a bad rep. And once you get a bad rep, you'll never get a game again. Who wants that? People don't believe it, but there's honor in gambling. You take Pug, a.k.a. Puggy Wuggy, a longtime poker legend and golf gambler. With Pug, you know he's going to cheat at golf. You know he's going to drop balls secretly out of his pocket when his original is lost, and improve his lie, and pull his card over your ball in the rough, so you can't find it. You figure it into the bet. In fact, some of the cheating that goes on is sort of admired. There was once a bulbous man named Jack Strauss whose best skill was getting low in a bunker, swinging with his left hand and throwing the ball out with his right. "Nobody better at that ever," Dewey says with admiration. No strokes either. At Dewey's joint, nobody gets pops but the caddies. "We give spots," he says, meaning they give head starts. For instance, Dewey might play from the backs and you get the ladies' tees. Or Dewey might play from the whites and you get to start from the 150-yard markers. Or maybe you get to foozle it everywhere. Or never take a penalty stroke. Stuff like that. Sometimes they'll give a reverse spot, which is your opponent gets to take any three clubs out of your bag. For instance, he might take your three wood, your pitching wedge, and your putter. Suddenly you're putting with your four iron. Or they might make you play with all woods and no irons. Not easy to blast out of a greenside bunker with a five-wood. Sometimes you think of a good spot and it backfires on you. Dewey once bet three-time World Series of Poker champ Stewie Unger $100,000 that he couldn't beat him even with Stewie teeing up from the 150s and getting to use a tee anytime, anywhere. Problem is, the next day Stewie shows up with every length of tee known to man. Some are 6 inches, some are a foot, some are 3 feet. He looked like a carpenter. If his ball was in the tall rough, Stewie would tee it up and suddenly be above the crap. If he had a side hill lie, Stewie was even again. One time Stewie chunked one into the edge of a pond, used the 3-foot tee, and suddenly had a nice dry shot. Some lessons you learn cost more than others, Dewey shrugs. When Dewey plays touring pros, and he's taken Hella Jack off Love, David Frost, Robert Damron, Paul Azinger, Andy Bean, Fulton Allam, and Dennis Watson, among others, he's got a standard bet. The pro has to play from the back tees, and Dewey plays from the next set up. That's 7,200 versus 6,800. And get this, they completely skip the par fives. They're too good on the fives, so we don't play them. Then I figure I'm even odds to beat them from the 150s in, because I can putt lights out. And I can get to the 150 marker a lot easier than they can. They got to hook it around trees and lakes and shit, and I don't. Plus, the greens at Southern Dunes are among the slickest in the world. If you got any choke in you, it'll come out on those greens, buddy. One time this big-time player-manager came down, and this guy really had the nuts. He could really play. But those greens drove him crazy. Finally, they just broke him. He had a 2-footer and he couldn't pull the trigger, bring himself to putt it. And he started to cry, right then and there. Our greens made a man cry. One time I took Frosty to play 7 guys in a 7-on-2 deal. Our best ball versus their best ball. Frosty shot 62. I gave him a free 10% roll. Frosty was entitled to 10% of Dewey's winnings and none of his losses. At the end of the day, I won $100,000, and he won $10,000. He couldn't believe it. He had no idea we were playing for that much. That's why I didn't tell him. He might not have been able to breathe. See, we hit shots the pros can't. We know how to hit it out of a 2-inch plug. Nobody else practices that shot. I can spin the shit out of it off a cart path, and they can't because they never have to do it. Buddy, there ain't a pro alive that can beat me. You know Phil Mickelson and Tiger, right? Well, you tell them they ain't barred from my place. They're welcome any time. They want to play $50,000 a hole? I'll play it. They wouldn't bust 68 at my place first time out. Now that I'd like to cover. With Dewey, you go in style, and so it was I became the first caddy in history to travel to the golf course in the back of a silver stretch limo. It was sent by Shadow Creek Golf Club, Steve Wynn's mind-bending masterpiece 20 minutes outside of town, a Xanadu that sits in the middle of desolation and yet is as lush as Vermont. It's as though God dropped a green hanky in the middle of the desert. What you had here in the back seat was A. Dewey, B. another character called Hill Street, or Hilly. Dewey and Hilly are permanent partners. They might be on opposite teams some days, but no matter what, day after day, they share the wins and losses 50-50. C. A rotund, red-faced Alabama boy named Billy Mack, who looks like he could have been kin to Azer's big boy. And D. Phil, one of the largest bookies in the country, a frenetic Easterner who is occupying one of the largest suites at the Mirage. Phil is known far and wide as the best tipper in Las Vegas. If he shakes your hand, you'll usually find $300 in it afterward. At Stefano's Italian restaurant at the Golden Nugget, if a waiter comes up and sings a good song to Phil's girlfriend, that waiter will suddenly find himself $500 richer. In fact, the best fights in Vegas do not involve Don King. They involve the caddies at Shadow Creek, fighting for Phil's bag. Oh, and E, me, with exactly $67 in my pocket. The four of them began settling up yesterday's action. "You owe me six," Dewey said to Billy Mack, the big Southerner. "Six?" "Six." Six, of course, means $60,000, so Billy Mack pulled them out of his pocket in tight rolls of $100 bills, rubber-banded at $10,000 each, and flipped Dewey six. He flipped them like a barmaid flips drink coasters. "Same bet today," said Billy Mack. "You got it," said Dewey. Dewey stuck them in his pocket, and Hilly said to Dewey, "Don't lose those now." Then he said to me, "He's always leaving money places." It's true. One time Dewey left $40,000 in a brown paper bag at a TCBY. He left $30,000 in the trunk of a car once. "I'm constantly finding tens, $10,000 rolls, in coat pockets and the bottoms of luggage." Reminder to self, check rental car for possible Dewey droppings. "That's nothing," Dewey said, then told how his mentor, two-time World Series of Poker champ and legendary golf hustler Doyle Brunson, once moved without ever finding the $300,000 in gold Krugerrands he buried in his backyard. Dewey is better, but Hilly's damn clutch. He's one of those bastards that starts the day 6-7-6 and finishes 4-2-3 when everything's tripled. Although the other day, Dewey was about to board a flight for London to play in a poker tournament when his cell phone rang. It was Hilly going, "I'm down 280, $280,000, after 2 days. Dewey changed his flight and flew to California to help him. "He gets all turned around," Dewey explained. Still, Dewey trusts him. "I know he ain't gonna parking lot me, pretend he's my partner, then lose on purpose and split the winnings with the opponents." These kinds of boys never write checks. Not for anything. "If you don't got cash, then I don't want to be paid," says Hill Street. The legendary gambler Amarillo Slim, who was playing in the World Series a table or two away from Dewey, says the same thing that night. "I'd rather have a gambler's word than any businessman's check. I got shoeboxes full of bounced businessmen's checks. Gamblers pay in cash." Dewey's gang doesn't much go for dealing with businessmen anyhow. "I won't play square Johns, businessmen," says Dewey. "You beat them and they say, 'You hustled me,' or 'You conned me,' or 'You set me up.' I don't need it. I don't play pigeons, players who are easy pickings, neither. Everybody thinks we're out here conning people. We ain't. We're playing each other. I don't play poor people, and I don't play square Johns. They'll bet millions on a stock, but you got to get a court order to get some of them nits, people who don't bet, up to $100 a hole. I play gamblers. Gamblers understand losing. They lose every day." Dewey was imploring me to understand, gesturing with his arms. "See, a guy's got to have the gamble, the innate desire to gamble, in him," Dewey continued. "He's got to be the kind of guy who will give you 50,000 on a flip of a coin. Some guys don't have the gamble in them, see? They wouldn't go 50 on a flip of a coin if you gave them 3-to-1 odds. Some of their ilk come in silk, such as Bill Macbeth, an immaculately handsome and elegantly dressed man who happens to be president of the Mirage and of Shadow Creek. He looks like he should be in a polo catalog, not trying to make 3-foot gaggers for $100,000. "You have to love to bet," says Macbeth. "I know guys worth $4 billion who wouldn't bet a truckload of flour could make 2 biscuits. All four in the limo agreed that even though they were friends, they were going to bet each other high that day. In fact, if they didn't, it'd be an insult. "Hell, you're in Vegas," says Dewey. "Everything is air-conditioned. The food is good and free. They got the game on to bet, and they're playing poker. It's heaven, man. You gotta make it worth a guy's while to go out there and sweat. Besides, as Hill Street points out, you got to bet your friends 'cause your enemies don't come around. When we arrived at Shadow Creek, the boys found it to be a bit crowded. It was 10 a.m. and already two other groups had gone off that day. Everything was free, of course, the golf, the food, sweaters in the pro shop, the carts, because of the monopoly cash they drop at the tables. All of a sudden, out on the first tee box, we had a six-some, so it would be indies, individual bets as opposed to team. Dewey explained his strategy. Hope you like brackets. Everybody thinks it's all done on one, the first tee, Dewey cautioned. But it ain't. You might give the guy the best of it, the advantage in the setting up of the bet, in order to get it back later. You can give him the best of it, but only if he plays higher, for more money, than he's comfortable with, you know. Or you give him the best of it and then get him to double the bets later, or get him to readjust, take fewer strokes on the back nine. He'll find a way to lose, trust me. I used to be a goose, the easy loser, but I learned, I know now when I got the nuts, the decided advantage. Dewey decides to go a little light on the bets, hoping to set up Phil for bigger action tomorrow. He arranged $20,000 two-down automatics with Phil, $5,000s with Hilly, and $5,000s with Azer's Big Boy. He bet a lousy dime, $1,000, with some nit named Dave, an L.A. CEO, in miles over his head, and finding the number of oxygen molecules in Las Vegas a little low at the moment. Since we weren't at Dewey's course, everything was decided with shots. Dewey gave everybody a few shots, plus he gave Billy Mack a spot, letting him tee off from the front of the front tee box. One time Dewey gave a guy 100 feet from the front of the women's tee box, but the guy kept walking way too far before he'd tee off. The next day, Dewey brought 100-foot rope. A man can lie, he says, but a rope can't. And they do lie. One time Dewey came to the clubhouse and met his opponent for the first time. Guy said he hadn't played for 6 months. That's when Dewey noticed the perfect tan line across his left hand. You don't get that playing softball, pal. Dewey's also bet $5,000 with a young stud hoss named Ty, who actually is a greeter facilitator at the course but wants nothing more than to be Dewey when he grows up. Hey, Dewey, he said, I nearly got to Bean Valley the other day. Bean Valley is gamblese for losing $100,000 in a single day. He seemed proud of it, like a young race driver telling his dad, finally hit the wall in turn three the other day, Pops. And the dad proudly going, yeah, it ain't soft, is it, boy? And so Dewey said wistfully to Ty, hell yeah, I remember my first trip to Bean Valley. So off we went, six players, six carts. These are gamblers, you think they're going to share carts? Plus three other sweats, people watching the match, and a Shadow Creek buddy with an injury. On the fender of each cart, each player has globbed a pile of Vaseline or KY jelly ever ready. They do it to smooth the grooves on the faces of their clubs, so absolutely no spin is imparted on the shots. Ty went first and bombed 1-360 right down the sprinkling system. Everybody else was dead straight too, and not one of them less than 250, many 300. Telling you, grease is the word. In the cart, Dewey explained that he wouldn't mind losing money on the front nine to set up bigger bets on the back nine and again tomorrow. Now look, I want to win, but I don't want to show too much. I want to kind of squeak it out, you know? For that reason, he wasn't going to putt between his legs until he needed it, hoping the boys might double the bets and then he could bring out his secret weapon. He'd done pretty much the same thing 2 days before with a guy named Ricky who'd sat next to him the night before at the poker tournament. The guy complained that there wasn't a damn thing to do during the day. That's when Dewey's eyebrows raised a little. Well, want to come out tomorrow and play a little golf with me? As far as invitations go, it's the equivalent of the wolf asking the sheep to dinner. Dewey fleeced the guy for $65,000. It wasn't high, Dewey said, but it was something to do. Dewey has a lot of ways to come out the winner. One good one is to catch the guy just off the jet. Give him the best of it, because he'll be too stiff to play. The second is to catch a guy just coming off a lesson. Dewey used to bring guys down to Greenleaf in Florida, and just as a show of friendship, set them up with a lesson with the famed teacher David Ledbetter. As with any lesson, they'd come out as twisted as a corkscrew. Then I'd take them out and bust their ass for 36 holes. One thing Dewey never does, it turns out, is take a caddy. He only took me, I have a suspicion, to immortalize himself and his buddies in literature. I don't like caddies, 'cause when you're playing high, you don't want to depend on nobody but yourself, and I don't want to be able to blame anybody but myself. Why? 'Cause when you can blame somebody else, you're making excuses, and when you're making excuses, you're setting yourself up to be the goose next time, too. Still, I tried to get him yardages and pin positions and hand him clubs, but he was getting everything himself anyway, and all I was doing was bumping into him all the time. Pretty soon I was going to hurt him, and hurt or not, in gambler's rules, you pay off through nine. "Why don't you just stay in the cart?" he said kindly. Benched after 1.5 holes. And yet I still managed to screw up. It was the third hole, and Billy Mack hit an approach that looked pretty good in the air. "Nice shot," I said. I realized it was the first time anybody had complimented anybody shot the first 3 holes. "Better not say anything," Dewey gently scolded. "You might say nice lag to a guy when he was trying to make it for $10,000. They don't want to hear nice lag, nice putt, nothing." "It ain't exactly like playing with your wife. Nobody even pretends to look for anybody's ball, except Dewey looks for Hilly's and Hilly looks for Dewey's. Hilly played better than Dewey on the front 9, which is good, since Dewey shot 41 and lost $27,000. He didn't seem torqued about it, though, and he still hadn't putted between his legs. Sadly, Phil didn't want to raise the stakes on the back, so Dewey was stuck playing low. He looked like a kid who just found out Christmas will be postponed indefinitely. At one point on the back 9, Ty, who goes about 6'5 and looks like he ought to be on a Wheaties box, had about $20,000 on the line. He was waiting his turn to hit when I asked him why he risks this kind of money, when he certainly can't be making the kind of monster bills Dewey pulls down. "I used to be a college jock, you know," he said, "football, baseball, but this right here, this is how I get my rocks off now." Ty bets the high rollers and the jocks when they come to town. He just finished a few days with Atlanta pitcher John Smoltz and apparently took much more than he gave in $5,000 Nassaus. He tangles with Michael Jordan when he comes to town, giving him 2.5 a side, though he won't say who wins what. A gambler I know at Atlanta's famously high-betting club, Hawks Ridge, says Jordan tends to lose more than he wins. "He came down and got me for $100,000 last month," the guy said, "but I got him for $200,000 the last trip." Could be lying, though. I also checked in with the CEO from L.A. to see how his lungs were working. "Man," he said on the 10th hole, "I'm ruined for member guests at my own club and $20 games. You can't get it up for them once you had the adrenaline of these babies pumping through you. It teaches you discipline of the mind. If you start thinking of what you could lose, you want to go slit your throat." But why bring reality into this? At Shadow Creek, reality is only an option. It's hard to tell whether you're in Oregon, Colorado, or one of Steve Wynn's lobbies. Once you're inside, there's no seeing out. And yet you can't resist. Sometimes I'd pull the cart over, pull apart a section of the 10-foot-high hedge that surrounds the place, and peer out into the very real, flat, barren desert all around us. It's like looking behind the background jungle scenery at Paramount and seeing only cardboard boxes and union guys eating out of their lunch boxes. The gamblers are not interested in the beauty of the course, or its fantasy, or each other's family lives. They are only interested in the bets, and Dewey is losing exactly on the right schedule. He shoots another 41 on the back 9, perhaps helped by Phil's quick triggering him on 12T. This time he wins $26,000 on the back 9 bets. For the whole day, though, he loses $21,000, which he probably has in the seat cushions of his rental car. You got the feeling he didn't mind on account of his partner, Hilly, was doing a very good impression of Tom Watson. He made back-to-back birdies, then aced the par 3-17th. That's not a bad hole to have an ace on, either. An incredible par 3-17th, the majestic waterfall hole at Shadow Creek that is missing only Acapulco cliff divers. Hilly shot 75 for the day, despite the fact that he says he's about a 10. Hey, Hilly, would you be free for a member guest? Young Ty said he ended up pocketing $5,000. The CEO lost $10,000. Good old Hilly won $68,000 on the day, and since $58,000 of that was from people other than Dewey, Dewey's cut is $29,000. and since Hilly covers half of his $21,000 loss, Dewey really lost only $10,500. So the $10,500 he lost, plus the $29,000 he won on Hilly's half, minus the $10,000 he lost straight up to Hilly, means he wound up ahead $8,500 for the day. "That's okay," Dewey said, scratching those straight-up hair bristles of his. "This ain't no one-day event. This is a lifetime deal. It don't hurt to lose. I don't mind showing him, Phil. I can play bad. Then when the stakes are higher, I might just get lucky and wind up playing good." Imagine that. Elephants eat 20 hours a day. Sharks must keep moving to live. And Dewey Tomko must have action every waking hour or he'll die. That's why even though he only had 1 hour sleep last night and we've already had a late huge Italian meal and I need chopsticks to keep my lids apart, Dewey says now we must go see what kind of dollars are to be had at the poker tables. He has always been like this, even when he taught migrant kids in kindergarten in Polk County, Florida. He'd play poker all night, from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m., then hightail it for the classroom, usually smelling like smoke and other people's whiskey and old pizza. "Hey kids, can you spell Advil?" When nap time came, Dewey would lie right down on a mat with the rest of the 5-year-olds. Problem was, sometimes the kids couldn't wake Dewey up. The parents would just tiptoe in, take their children home, and Dewey would wake up about 5:30, then head for the poker game again. He knew it was time to quit when he had $98,000 in his jeans, 2 pigeons at the table, but had to leave for his $5,400-a-year job. He left for Vegas the next day. "Buddy, I can't change a light bulb," he says. "Can't hammer a nail. Can't do one damn thing real well in the world except play poker." By 1982, Dewey became the number one ranked poker player in the world. "I just know how to read people," he explains. Take, for instance, a favorite pigeon who used to fly up from Florida to play him. "I had this tell on this old boy that couldn't miss." A tell is a read on a player that gives away what kind of cards he has. "See, every time he had the nuts, the good cards, he had to have some water out of his bottle. If he didn't go to the water, it meant he was petrified and didn't have the card, so he'd try to just sit very still and not give away how scared he was to be bluffing. That old boy paid off like a slot machine." Figuring out a good tell isn't cheating, though Dewey has seen every kind of cheating there is. "Guys putting in their call, bet, and sliding money back out as they bring their hands back," Dewey says. "Or guys using a tiny mirror on their fingernail to see the card as they deal." He's also seen marked cards, sleeved cards, stoolies across the table, tipping cards. And still, the only way to beat him was usually with a gun. He used to play cards now and again against a bodyguard for a big-time mobbed-up Vegas guy. This thug had been indicted 21 times for murder but never convicted. It was the weirdest coincidence. All the witnesses kept showing up in coffins. "One time we had this real high game and it was him against me," Dewey recalls. "I was bluffing, but he couldn't tell. Real high money on the line. And he looks right at me and says, 'Dewey, if you're bluffing, I'll kill you.' And every time I'd raise him, he'd say it again. He'd look real hard at me before he'd call me and he'd go, 'Dewey, you better not be bluffing, else I'll kill you.' I was so scared. It came down to the final bet and he looked at me one last time and folded. And I threw my cards in before he could see him. And he stands up real mad and says, 'Well, did you have them cards or not?' And I said, 'Of course I had them.' And I was sweating so much I nearly ruined the deck." "Ma'am, would you happen to have a change of underwear handy?" It's not as bad as the time Dewey was at a game when a rough kind of character tapped out, broke, but stayed around to sweat the game. One of the leading players left for a moment to take a dump, taking his money with him. The poor sap was in the stall when he saw a gloved hand holding a Glock revolver come under the door. "Give me that money," said a voice. The man handed it over. Well, under. When he came out, the bent nose was suddenly back in the game and our hero was suddenly sweating the game himself. Tomko won so much money from one of his World Series of Poker second place finishes that he went home and bought Southern Dunes with the cash. It's a British-style links course. Naturally, Dewey changed the names of the holes. Now they're called, among others, Anti-Up, Dealer's Choice, and Dewey's Double Down. And that was the first drip of money that would soon flow like it was coming out of a fire hose. "Everybody to me looked like a piece of chocolate cake," he says. All that cake bought orange groves, real estate, and part of a Costa Rican casino. Then again, God knows how much he'd own if he wasn't so damn stupid with his money. Dewey has lost millions in schemes you couldn't trick an Alzheimer's patient into. He lost piles searching for the Titanic, processing gold in El Paso, processing gold in South America, rescuing gold doubloons from a ship sunk off Venezuela, backing a Christian radio station that had no antenna. That's the problem with gamblers. They don't know when to stop. One time, years ago, I won $10,000 off Steve Wynn. When he handed it to me, he said, "Put this in stock in the Golden Nugget." That was his first hotel in Vegas. The stock was $4. But no, I wouldn't do it. Instead, I went and blew it somewhere. I still can't remember what I did with it. I figured out the other day that $10,000 would have been worth $20 million now. For a few years, any money Dewey made on the poker tables, he'd lose right back on the golf course, most of it to the redoubtable Doyle Brunson, the place where all rookie gambling money goes to die. Brunson, of Fort Worth, Texas, is a FedEx truck of a man, over 400 pounds, and arguably the greatest poker player in history. He may be the only man alive who has won more money gambling golf than Dewey. Naturally, we met Doyle at a steakhouse. Even though he's got a diet bet going, if he can lose 100 pounds in the next 6 months, he wins $200,000. He orders food like he's going to the electric chair in the morning. So far, he says he's lost, well, 20 pounds. He'll probably just pay the guy the $100,000 settlement and never miss a bite. Losing weight is the only thing Brunson can't do. He's as tough as a bus station steak and smarter than NPR. A wise guy once mentioned that he'd put a dozen ice picks in Brunson if he didn't start cheating in a certain poker game and cutting the wise guy half. Brunson refused, then showed up the next night with his own wise guy. It was a wise guy standoff. Brunson once played poker for 5 days and five nights without sleep. He's been jailed 50 times for playing poker. He's seen four guys drop dead at the poker table, one of old age, one of a heart attack, one of mysterious circumstances, and one shot by a jealous husband. "He came flying in, firing, and we all went flying out the back door, money in our fists. We dove in the river and swam." A devout Christian, Brunson is not big on showing mercy to his vanquished. "I won't take money off a milkman making $20,000 a year," he says, "but I'll damn sure take it off a gambler." Once, playing pool, he took everything off a man, right down to his skivvies. The man even lost his car to Brunson. He said he'd walk home, get the car, and bring it to the back door. It was 10 years before Brunson saw the guy again. Said Brunson, unsmiling, "You gave me just enough time to cool down." His only equal in American gambling history may be the legendary hustler Titanic Thompson, whom he knew well. "I saw him pitch a key into a keyhole once," Brunson recalls. "I lost money to him playing horseshoes once. He just threw ringer after ringer. Damnedest thing I ever saw. I once lost a bet to him that he couldn't throw an acorn over a building. Damn thing had a BB in it." Brunson's trick for winning on the golf course was taking the worst of it, in the bet setup, but making them bet for a hell of a lot more than they were comfortable. They always choke. And for the first few years, that choker was Dewey. "My first trip to Vegas," Dewey remembers, "I had $95,000 to bet with him. He sent me home on the plane with nothing. He was the best I ever saw. I'd win a bunch more, come back out, and lose it all to him again." But he learned. He went from a goose to a goose slayer. Brunson stopped betting against him and started taking some of his action. He had a standing $100,000 bet that nobody could whip Dewey in a putting contest, providing Dewey could putt between his legs, of course. Dewey's will became diamond-plated. He used to play hitmen and drug dealers. "I wasn't scared," he remembers. "They weren't going to kill me. They just needed the gamble. I'd clean them out and they'd leave town and come back the next week with $50,000 more. Sometimes they'd pay you with money that was all singed or smoky, like they blew up a safe or something for it. I didn't know. I never asked." He and Brunson won so much money it was comical. "We used to pick up the paper and laugh at the leading money winners on tour," Dewey says with a grin. Hell, sometimes Doyle'd make more in one day than the leader would make in a whole year. Square Johns tried to hire Dewey to run casinos and whatnot, but Dewey never took the jobs. I had to ask a friend of mine once, they're offering me $200,000 a year. Is that a good salary? I mean, I just didn't know. And he never took the job either. Why should I ever take a job? I never have to do anything I don't wanna. I eat the best food. I stay at the best hotels. I get up in the morning and say, well, what'll I play today? Maybe a football game? Maybe go to the pool hall? Maybe play golf? Maybe go shoot some free throws for money? Man, this gambling life is the best. But you wonder. He is the father of three boys who he rarely gets to see. His marriage is troubled. He never allowed cards at home and warned his boys against becoming gamblers. There must be something he hated about it. And yet his boys have become gamblers anyway. One of his boys was in Vegas at the same time as us, staying at the same hotel, and yet Dewey rarely saw him. No wonder a kind of loneliness settles into Dewey sometimes. Here it was, way time to call it a night, and he couldn't help himself. He just had to wander back over to Binion's and jump back in a game, knowing he would be flipping cards again all night, his earplugs in to keep out the distractions, not particularly talking to anybody, not particularly laughing much. He'd just end up winning or losing another $100,000 that will end up meaning no more in his life than a pocketful of lint will mean in yours. From what I saw, he's an addict. Clean, well-dressed, perfectly polite, handsome, funny, richer than Croesus, and absolutely trapped by a disease known as action. Each day, each hour, each minute, he feeds the beast, and yet it only makes the beast hungrier. Before I left him to find my pillow, he said that at 8 tomorrow morning we would feed the beast again. In the limo ride this morning, the talk is of Big Al. Dewey would dearly love a piece of Big Al, because mostly Big Al is the biggest goose of Christmas. Word is, Big Al won $260,000 on the craps tables last night, and Dewey would very much like to relieve him of all the headaches that come with such a windfall, i.e. taxation, financial planning, and the dizzying number of investment choices. In fact, Dewey nearly needs a napkin, he is salivating so much over Big Al. This will give you an idea how much of a chop Big Al is. The last time Big Al was in Vegas, he and Phil were going high, $60,000 Nassaus. They were playing the very difficult 18th at Shadow Creek as though they were wearing boxing gloves and using snow shovels. One was on one side of the green, seemingly permanently bunkered, and the other was having a chunkathon with his lob wedge. Finally, Phil was about to attempt a two-footer. "What's that for?" Big Al hollered across from the bunker. 13, hollered Phil. "Pick it up," Big Al yelled. "I can't beat that." You don't get a goose like Big Al every day, but they do come along. The late Stewie Unger was that way. If Dewey is a 10 out of 10 on the gambling addiction scale, Stewie was a 23. One time Dewey bet Stewie $400,000 he couldn't break 120. Stewie got up on the first tee with about 30 guys sweating the bet and whiffed his first 8 swings. Stewie threw down his club, spun around, and said, "Which one of you motherfuckers bent my clubs?" Former welcome-back Cotter star Gabe Kaplan is the spruce goose of geese. A rabid poker player, gambler, and golf action hound, Kaplan once bet a friend $1 million that he'd break 90 in his lifetime. Kaplan still hasn't done it. My question is, how does the friend collect? "The minute Gabe gets it, he loses it," says Dewey. "But hell, I ain't worried about Gabe. He's set. He got 2 stock tips when he was a young man that made him $30 million. He can fuck around all he wants. It's just that some guys always find a way to win, like Doyle, and some guys always find a way to lose, like Gabe." And if the geese don't know the way, Dewey will find it for them. One time Dewey and former Boston Red Sox star Ken "Hawk" Harrelson were in a huge 3-day game at Isleworth, the creamy Orlando resort where Tiger, Ken Griffey, and Arnold Palmer live. They were playing a very evil game called backgammon, wherein a cube sits in a cart. Each team has the right to turn the cube to double the bet, then double again until the cube collapses from exhaustion. They were playing $40,000 a hole before the cube had been turned a single time. After the first night, it hit Dewey that a team could easily lose $600,000. So the next morning, Dewey showed up on the first tee with a clear plastic bag containing $600,000 in hundreds. He held it up in front of their opponents and said, "You boys ready to lose this much?" Shortly thereafter, they started gagging. To his undying credit, Big Al wants no part of Dewey today. There is nothing Dewey can say to be part of the group. Hell, it would only be an eightsome, Dewey argues. But Big Al looks to me like a man who would no sooner want to bet Dewey in golf than he would like to fill a cavity in a sick crocodile. Now you see why Dewey is spending more and more time lately in Costa Rica. The geese are running from the axe. This so seems to disgust Dewey that he dispatches his very own caddy. "I'm staking you in a game against Ty," he says. $1,000 Nassau. I want you to clean him out." He says this laughing. Dewey no more cares about a $1,000 Nassau than he cares about the new Paris fashions. He just wants me out of his hair. Secretly, I think he blames yours truly for his losing the day before. He'll play with three others in the group behind Big Al, hoping he can get them into something worth leaving the air conditioning for. As for me, I'm bad luck, a distraction, an excuse waiting to be used, and Dewey just doesn't do excuses. So, dressed in sneakers, using borrowed clubs, and nervous as Barney Fife, I play for 10 times the amount I've ever bet. Ty has scorecard bets with everybody all over the course, so I'm no more than a gnat buzzing near his knee. For me, it's scary, but not palm-sweating scary. I know Dewey has more than I could possibly lose stuck in his shoe bag. Still, I win the front nine and $1,000. My mistake is telling Ty I've beaten him, which reminds him he has a bet with me at all, which propels him to whomping my gluteus on the back nine to win that bet plus the 18. Dewey comes back to the ranch about 20 G's richer, minus the news I'm about to give him. "We lost $1,000 all day, Dewey," I say timidly. And he says, "What do you mean, we?" If the caddy says, "Could you believe the hawk today? It was blowing brass monkeys. We had to tie Woozy to a tree. Guys were out there making like Frosties and Bo Derricks. I think Karnak made Malcolm on 11. We were in the Brillo so much I should have wore waders." He means, "Could you believe how hard the wind was blowing on the golf course today? It was blowing very, very hard. It was so windy, in fact, we had to tie Welsh pro Ian Woosnam, who is only 5'5", to a tree or he would have blown away." Of course, I am only speaking figuratively, not literally. Many players were making eights on holes and even tens. I think Jack Nicklaus made an X on the 11th hole, which is to say I'm not sure he ever finished the hole at all. My player and I were in the rough so often I should have worn rubber fishing pants to protect my pant legs, though again, I do not mean this literally. Chapter 7. Jack Nicklaus. We'll always have Vail. Perhaps the lowest moment in your life was unwittingly dragging 8 feet of toilet paper by your heel through the entire Nobel Peace Prize procession. Or maybe you accidentally served your new Amish in-laws pornographic fortune cookies. Or chances are you sneezed a hawker into a sultan's soup. For me, it was when Jack Nicklaus's umbrella suddenly collapsed hideously upward, causing me to lurch to save it, causing me to dump nearly all his golf clubs out of the bag onto the sopping turf, just as he was asking me for a new ball, many of which were starting to run down a slope toward an unfathomable cavern. This was not just the lowest moment of my life. It would be the lowest moment in a mole's life. It would be the lowest moment of Shirley MacLaine's lives. After all, I had convinced the greatest golfer in history that I could do this, that I was a real caddy who wouldn't mess up, wouldn't be a bother, and most of all, wouldn't embarrass him. Which was true, sort of. I wound up embarrassing only myself. This was a moment that actually surpassed, in sheer agony, the first day I met Nicklaus. This was 15 years before, the Wednesday of the 1986 Masters, the one that some people, including me, believe is the greatest Masters ever played. The one where Nicklaus came from 5 down with 9 to play, shot 30 on the back, and won his 6th green jacket at age 46, with his son Jackie on the bag, no less. That win is still the single largest